Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. How democratic was Germany in the prelude to the First World War, and what were the tensions in politics and society that ensured so much trust was placed in militarism? In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talked to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about Kaiser Wilhelm II, his chancellors, and the mood of a modernising country racing towards catastrophe.
Wilhelm II, the last of the rulers of the German Second Reich, who was emperor from 1888 to 1918, is obviously an important figure, not just in German history, but in European history. And indeed, the impact of the First World War, what became the First World War, the Great War as it was to contemporaries, not just on Europe, but around the world, is such that Wilhelm II must be regarded as a significant figure. Now, we're fortunate in the case that we have for Wilhelm a, what in my view is, generally agreed to be an extremely fine biography by Grohl, published in English, which is pretty damning, I have to say, about Wilhelm's character, his intentions, and his influence. And if you read that, and if you also think about the work that has been done on the role of the German General Staff in actively planning and preparing for war, then you have to be very sceptical about the attempt, most recently associated with the historian Christopher Clark, to suggest that in some way everybody was at fault. I suppose the modern equivalent of that would be the Pope arguing that we're all to blame for President Putin's aggression in Ukraine. That is, may seem to you a laughable comparison, but in practical terms, what we know and understand about the opinion-making context of the Wilhelmine court and Wilhelmine society does not encourage any optimism about the possibility of restraining Germany from embarking in war. Wilhelm II was in some respects psychologically a figure that prefigured Hitler. He was mediocre, he was difficult, he was endlessly self-regarding, and to an extent that I think most people would regard as narcissistic. And I think it's also fair to say that both men were fairly perverse sexually. And he concentrated and compounded the problem by focusing power on himself, again, a characteristic we see with Hitler, and on his sycophants, again, a characteristic we see with Hitler, not least through destabilizing ministries by his appointments, his policies, his use of ministerial reshuffles, and his crass interventions in foreign policy. And again, I think we can see many comparisons. And of course, you will remember, I've written about this in my work on the causes of World War I, the debate over the German scholar Fritz Fischer's argument that in many senses, Wilhelmine Germany prefigured much of the expansionist tendencies, the aggression, and the willingness to go to war that one associates with the Third Reich. And there was, if you think about it, a sort of quick change in politics, which meant that it was really very difficult for others to, if you like, restrain the emperor. The emperor himself was, of course, aggressive in his political attitudes. He described, for example, the Social Democratic Party as lacking a fatherland. He was quite happy to see action against it, and legal action included the imprisonment of its leaders. But he also destabilized ministries whom in no sense of the imagination could be seen on the left. And again, that prefigured Hitler. So you have the overthrow of Bismarck, not generally noted as a rabid socialist, And then you have a whole series of short ministries, Leo von Caprivi, the chancellor in 1890 to 94, who gave his name due to German expansion to that strip of territory in which German Southwest Africa, now Namibia, stretched eastwards. He was succeeded by the Prince of Hohenlohe-Schillingfurst, who was succeeded by Bernhard von Bülow, and then by Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg. These ministries were not in a position to press hard on the circles around the Kaiser, and in specific terms in foreign policy, the Kaiser very much, so the Emperor, very much took the view that foreign policy was his, that he was not accountable for it, and he had an exactly the same attitude to military policy, which in a sense built on Bismarck's move of the military sort of control and accountability and accounts really from out of the civil sphere. And that gave the emperor an extraordinary power in the system. There was a sharply political dimension with the socialism of many, though not all, working class activists regarded on the right as a threat to an ability and a willingness to fight. In other words, the theme of the enemy begin and within, the theme of the enemy within, does not begin with defeat in World War I. It prefigures it, as indeed does anti-Semitism. And this is seen by the right as justifying anti-democratic measures, as with, for example, the electoral so-called reforms of 1895 to 96. The traditional military and social elite who looked to the Kaiser felt threatened by modernization, and they used militarism to defend their privileges and indeed to give them jobs. I mean, for much of the nobility, the military system, the state as a whole, was crucial to their ability to support their living standards. And if you think about it, I'm sure people writing 100 years hence or 150 years hence about societies like Britain today will argue the same thing about the middle class and the development of the state as a form of redistribution of power, privilege and profit to certain groups in the middle class. Anyway, going back to the Third Reich, in what was an increasingly volatile situation, I suppose prefiguring modern economic difficulties, urbanization and large-scale internal immigration, mass literacy, rapid industrialization, secularization, democratization, and nationalism, all of which were not necessarily moving in the same direction. There were often cross currents, as for example, between socialism and nationalism, but they were creating an uncertain and unfamiliar world. And you see that also in France, I suppose, in the agitation around the Dreyfus affair. And reflecting the sort of atavistic roots of Prussian militarism, the regime and the other anti-democratic groups sought to impose their view of order on the flux. And I think that's a very important way of looking at Germany. Germany at this period is dynamically growing in economic terms, it's growing in science, it's important in technology. There is an international reputation for the excellence of German solutions. The British National Efficiency Movement, for example, looks to German models, and there was much interest in the German education system. But at the same time, German militarism presented a very different conception of where Germany was going. And there was a particular spatial dynamic. The wealth and political activism of industrial advance was concentrated in the West, particularly around the Ruhr and also in the circles around the great port of Hamburg, whilst much of the military elite based their position on land holdings in the agrarian East, in areas like East Prussia, Pomerania, Silesia, Brandenburg, where they felt threatened by Russia, which of course joined with Prussia and Austria as all having common borders in Poland. And the relative wealth of this land-holding elite was diminishing both within Germany and as a result of increased transoceanic trade globally. Now, we've got to handle these social categories with care. Not all landholders were conservative, just as not all of the working class was radical socialist. There was an important Catholic working class element, and conservatism meant different things. The conservatism of Brandenburg was different to the conservatism of, say, Westphalia or the Rhineland. But in contrast to Britain, there was not the same degree of mixing of landholders and successful middle class that helped to ensure a more stable and successful conservatism. Moreover, the landholding elite was particularly powerful in government. And I think that's very noticeable. I mean, the kind of moves that you see in Britain in the mid-1890s with inheritance tax, in the 1900s and even more particularly at the beginning of the 19-teens, were not matched in the same scale in Germany, but yet at the same time, the Germans on the right had a growing sense of instability, which encouraged their perceived need to respond by the use of force. Interestingly enough, the British right was less closely aligned with the military, and the most important branch of the British military, the Navy, was in fact much more associated with the Liberals than it was with the Conservatives. Anxiety in Germany about the strength of Russia combined increasingly from the 1890s with a bellicose nationalism and a fervent patriotism, a belief that war was a natural state and a conviction that it was honourable as well as necessary to fight and die for the country. And it's no accident that this is the period of the development of geopolitics, a term initially developed by a Swede, but very much taken forward by a German, Friedrich Ratzel, who argued in 1920 in his book On the Earth and the Life, he deployed the concept of Lebensraum, living space, a concept devised in 1860 by a German biologist. And this Ratzel emphasized the role of environmental circumstances in affecting what he saw as the process and progress of struggle between states. His political geography treated war as a normal process. And Ratzel's book was to be very much recommended to Hitler. So war was seen as a tool of policy. A strong armaments industry, it provided a key enabler, particularly companies such as Krupp. And faced by what was seen as the threat of Russia, the German military, under its last chief of the Imperial General Staff prior to World War I, Moltke, the nephew of the great Moltke, who'd been held that position during the German Wars of Unification, regarded the path to success of fighting with Russia as resting on an initial rapid defeat of France. You might think the same was to be followed in 1940, and you would be correct. A war on just one front could then be prepared. An overconfidence blinded policymakers to strategic realities. On top of that, German Weltpolitik, the ambition to become a world power, included the ability to overthrow Britain. And this was particularly attractive to Wilhelm II, who for psychological reasons and geopolitical reasons and social reasons disliked Britain, which he associated with commerce, with an absence of sort of the kind of militarism he believed in. And also Wilhelm II, as Royle showed in his biography, was heavily anti-Semitic, and he disliked the role of Jews as he saw it in British society. And as a result, Germany built up the second largest navy in the world, which not surprisingly didn't improve its relations with Britain. So a powerful Anglophobia saw British liberalism and capitalism as a threat to German culture, again prefiguring the situation under the Third Reich. And at the same time, there was a hostility to Russia. Now, I think I possibly, Graham, ought to give you a chance to say one or two things.
Well, Professor Black, you've covered so much ground there. There's a kind of Weltpolitik all in itself. So many areas to probe you more closely on. But I suppose I'd like to start with getting a sense of, I know a question a lot of historians have wrestled with, which is really, you know, how democratic was the German Empire between 1871 and 1918. In some ways, it was more democratic than Britain. I mean, every male adult had the vote, for example. But in other respects, the dispersal of where power was gave the executive powers that the legislature struggled to contain. I wonder if you could just give a sense of how much power the emperor and his chancellor had.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. There is a tension about it. In particular, there's a tension between the SPD support, which was about a third of the national vote by 1912, when that provoked conservative alarm. And you've got some historians, I think Richard Evans, for example, have argued that Germany was more democratic than Britain. I think the fundamental problem for me in that view, and obviously others will have different assumptions, but the fundamental problem for me is, as you know, I'm interested in foreign policy and war, and I don't really see any democratic control there at all. I see the government as being able to push through the measures it wants and get the resources it wants without any effective restraint or limit. Also, I would argue that in Britain, the key aspect of democracy is not so much the extent of the franchise, which you're quite correct, is not given to all males till 1918. Well, all males above a certain age. We still don't have, obviously, a universal male franchise, let alone or a universal female franchise. But the point is, I would say, is not so much that, it is that there are changes in government. And those changes in government are, you know, reasonably significant between what we could call the Conservatives and the Liberals. We'll leave aside for a moment the question of the Liberal Unionists. And then on top of that, these changes lead to substantive changes in the Constitution, the changes to the House of Lords, the Parliament Act, which is sort of, as it were, supported by two general elections. And then as a result of these two general elections, you have in effect a Liberal Labour Irish political alliance, which constrains the Conservatives in a way that is simply not the case in Germany. So that the Conservative government, it resigns in 1905, just to remind you, the Liberals under Campbell Bannerman come in, they win the 1906 general election, they win the next two general elections, and Conservative Britain appears dead. In fact, you might argue that it's only World War I that leads to the political changes that alter that situation. And on top of that, issues that were very dear to Conservatives, not allowing Irish home rule, but continuing Ireland within the very much on an equal basis within the Imperial Parliament in London, were passed. I mean, you know, that is being pushed through at the eve of World War I, and the government has overawed a military dissatisfaction, notably summarized in terms of the Curragh Mutiny, but it was more widespread than that. Now, you simply would not have had that happen in Germany. So I don't find it convincing. In fact, I'll take it a stage further. I think it is a fundamental misreading of the comparison between Britain and Germany. And I think that fundamental misreading comes because historians of Germany do not understand the actual workings of the British constitution and political system in the quarter century prior to World War I.
Would there be a just to play devil's advocate here, so just
I like that.
Humour me whilst I ask the question. Would there be a comparison, though, in foreign policy between a British government of the period using royal prerogative powers and the sort of executive authority that the Kaiser exercised?
Well, do you really think that George V was the key person in 1914 in taking Britain into war?
Well, you see, that would be the difference in the executive, though. The powers would be exercised by the Prime Minister and Cabinet in Britain, whereas the Kaiser's ability to dominate his Chancellor when it ceased to be someone of the power of Bismarck gave him the upper hand.
Well, I would argue that is the key point. And I would also argue that the extent to which the military is under the direct control of the Kaiser, who, of course, as you know, I presume you know this, loved hobnobbing with his generals, loved going to military manoeuvres. He irritated some of the generals because he liked the manoeuvres to end with a triumphant cavalry charge, which they found a bit ridiculous. But nevertheless, he hobnobbed with them to an extraordinary extent. So no, I don't find this convincing. I would argue that the practicality was that Germany was very different in its political culture. There were democratic aspirations there, but I think it's one of these classic cases. And I mean, I find it quite interesting, the argument that Germany was more democratic, because I think what you've got here is the sort of argument that's taking you towards, I'm not saying that people would necessarily hold this, that, as it were, a society like East Germany, where everybody in theory had the vote, was a democratic one. Well, I don't really see it like that, Graham, but you might have that viewpoint. I mean, you know, you're obviously very keen on constitutions and what they say.
If I have that viewpoint, I've kept it very quiet all these years. I'm obviously a sleeper. But I wonder how much we look at systems and how much at individuals. If someone of Bismarck's strength of character had continued to...
And political ability had
continued in his role, and of course, ultimately, the Kaiser Wilhelm sacked Bismarck and had the power to do so. But if there had been people of Bismarck's strength of ability and character continuing to be Chancellor in the 1890s and first years of the 20th century, might there have been a restraining hand on the Kaiser's ambitions?
Well, there might have been, yes. I mean, obviously, I as you know, I find counterfactualism fascinating. But I think one has to work out what one's really talking about. First of all, you were talking a minute or two ago about democracy, and you were arguing that Germany was more democratic. Well, if you look at the 1871 constitution under which the Reichstag was elected by universal male suffrage, the government was clearly responsible to the emperor, and to a very different extent to what we would understand as a democratic society. Moreover, there was a federal council, the Bundesrat, which had the ability to block constitutional change, and the power of Prussia was very much entrenched in that. And the power of the aristocracy itself was entrenched in the upper house of the Prussian, the Herrenhaus of the Prussian Parliament. So I think even constitutionally, I mean, I'm more interested in how constitutions work than the theory of them, but even constitutionally, I'd be dubious about this as a democracy. But as I said, you've got your point of view. But you can then take this a stage further. If you look at practical politics, Bismarck's room for manoeuvre is enhanced by the tensions between middle-class liberalism, working-class socialism, and by his own skill in producing effective expedients that lessened the pace, rate, and severity of disunity, and all to the credit of Bismarck. He associated in the 1880s, for example, the government with social welfare, including public insurance, creating the roots of the welfare state, etc. So that's not quite the same thing as democracy. You might argue that that's an attempt to hold democracy at bay. I think that's a significant point, but that's only going to work if you want to take a functionalist account. If the elite, well, however defined, and we're talking about particular social and military groups, the government and the Kaiser and his circle. It's only going to work if they hang together. And of course, the point is that Wilhelm II is not going to let that work because he's not interested psychologically in being constrained. And he has, in a sense, a variant, not quite of the divine right of kings, but of the, as it were, environmental necessity and destiny of emperors. Actually, that's rather good. We should try that one in some text or other. You can take this a stage further. Look at the theory, as I'm sure you have done, look at the theory that the elite has about war. Moltke, the elder, in a speech in the Reichstag in 1890, voiced his concern about what he called people's war. He didn't want unrestricted conscription. He feared this would create too many left-wing soldiers and middle-class officers. He didn't want the radical social changes and lengthy struggle to which that might lead. Now, the military has got a real set of problems, but it certainly cannot be said to be democratic. And I think, given the significance of the army in Wilhelmine Germany, its size, the amount of resources it absorbed, and ultimately its ability, because obviously it hadn't read the works of Christopher Clark and others, its ability to take Germany into war. I mean, given all of those factors, it's really quite remarkable that anybody should seriously propound the notion that Germany was an effective democracy.
The entwinement which you've spoken of between German conservatism and militarism and how much stronger that was than in other countries, for example, in Britain.
Or France.
I just want to explore that a little bit more deeply and wonder, if we go back to Bismarck's Kulturkampf against the Catholic Church, what was there a way in which the diminution, if that is right, the diminution of the power of naturally conservative institutions like the church, that being pushed aside by the state, was that a void that militarism filled, or actually is the kind of slightly imagined legacy of Frederick the Great and so on so powerful that militarism is always going to be at the heart of a reactionary view of German society?
Well, that's interesting. That's very interesting. I think that I wouldn't have to go back to Frederick the Great, but I would say that in Prussia in particular, but not only in Prussia, military service and the identity of one's particular role as a hereditary landowner with one's military service is true of quite a lot of the nobility in much of Germany, particularly northern and eastern Germany. Far less so in the Rhineland, for example, or in Baden-Württemberg, but nevertheless, there are many people there who have served. I would say that's significant. I would say also the degree to which the wars of unification of 1864 to 1871 and the way in which, as a backdrop, an alternative direction, possible direction for Germany, as envisaged, as you know, in Frankfurt in 1848, was not followed. I think those events are possibly more germane, more important than if one is thinking back to the legacy of Frederick the Great, who died in 1786, more easy to cite than to feel his influence, if you see what I mean. Although, people are quite happy to go and pose outside the garrison church in Potsdam, and we're to know that with the foundation of the Third Reich. I would argue that, yes, you're right. I would see it as a more militaristic society. Now, I'm not trying to deny that there are sections of the elite who have made their money, particularly in Hamburg, in maritime and oceanic matters and in the Ruhr in industry, but they don't have, they're not quite, they're not at all as influential in the German system as their counterparts in Britain. And I think that's interesting. I mean, there's been a whole host of discussion in the scholarly literature in Britain about when and how the landed elite becomes less influential in politics, in terms of wealth, in terms of policy, and indeed in terms of officership in the army. And as you will know, the general argument in a comparative context is that, of course, while the aristocracy are disproportionately, if you want to use that concept, wealthy and influential, nevertheless, they are considerably less so than, shall we say, in the 18 teens. And in Germany, I would argue the situation is different. I'm not using that to say that it's necessarily reactionary, because that presupposes that all countries should move in the same direction on the same track, and also presupposes that in some way progress, however defined, is measured by a certain set of military characteristics. Whereas, you know, we have at the present day the two largest economies in the world, the United States and China, are both formidable military societies. Although, interestingly, sorry, I should rephrase that, both have formidable militaries, though, interestingly, the United States is not what one would describe as a militaristic society. So maybe if you wish to be pejorative, and I'm not sure that I do, but I think we could at least think in the in this concept, maybe what you've got is a degree of immaturity in the German case, that it has developed a major economy, but is also retained a degree of militarism, which actually, in the end, gravely harms the economic strength that had built up by 1914.
And what about the unholy alliance between the kind of urban capitalists and traditional agrarian landowners? You know, whatever their differences, what they have in common, presumably, is a fear of the radical left. How radical was the left? I mean, should we see it as a strongly Marxist-influenced movement, or was it much more fragmented than that?
It is more fragmented than that. I think that's a very fair description. I mean, as you probably know, Saxony was referred to as the Red Kingdom. And that was the area where the SPD was particularly strong. And but you know, I think one's got to be careful. The SPD used Marxist language, but it also sought to pursue politics and power by democratic means. And if you're looking at the workers in the Ruhr, the Catholic Centre Party is particularly successful. So as I mentioned earlier, I'd be hesitant about saying that the working class was all on the left. That's the kind of argument that the left wanted to argue, and of course then used the notion of false consciousness for those of the working class who didn't vote left. But we know enough about the politics of our own country to know that these arguments about false consciousness are generally self-serving.
Mm-hmm. Let's look a little bit more at foreign policy and what you were saying about the development of a geopolitical framework to see it through. I mean, Germany has three very obvious potential rivals, I mean, particularly in colonially and in the seas, Britain, but also continentally, France, which is just defeated in 1870-1871, and Russia. Does it prioritize, and I'm thinking the period after Bismarck's fall now, does it prioritize the scale of threat from these enemies, or is it minded to see all of them as equally those to be taken on?
Well, the Franco-Russian alliance is a shock to the Germans. You could argue it's a result of their own failings. We can discuss that, but it's certainly a shock to the Germans. But the practicality was that I don't think that you would argue that the French and the Russians were particularly a threat to the Germans. As you will know, France nearly goes to war in 1898, and who does it nearly go to war with?
Britain.
Correct, the Fashoda crisis. Russia goes to war in 1904, and who does it go to war with?
Japan.
Correct. So there's no necessary, and we can go on. There are also war crises. There is no necessary reason to believe that the Franco-Russian alliance is going to have Germany primarily in its sights. Indeed, British commentators and ministers were very worried about that alliance and didn't really resolve their differences with France till 1904 and Russia till 1907. And even then, differences continued, particularly with Russia. So I think one's got to be careful here. And, you know, you could also argue, I would argue, that the Weltpolitik, you know, Tirpitz, shipbuilding, etc., is completely crass. The British don't want war with Germany. And I think it was particularly foolish. So I would suggest to you that Germany got provoked a world war that was unnecessary by any shape or stance. It wasn't threatened by the expansion of other powers. It was, you know, presented, obviously, as we know, there were Moltke and figures round him argued that they had to fight Russia before Russia had developed its rail network and was therefore able to mobilize more quickly. But that anxiety presupposes that you're going to war with Russia. And there was no inherent need to go to war with Russia. And you could argue, on top of that, that the Germans consistently exaggerated in the 19-teens the threat and strength of the Russian military system. But just as you could argue under the Third Reich that they underestimated it, or at least did so in 1941. So I myself would say that Wilhelm II was really, in my view, a conservative is somebody who prudentially and pragmatically looks at national interests and understands the value of caution. Well, I don't think any of that could be ascribed to Wilhelm II. That would be my view. Mm-hmm. The man was a fool. Let's be clear about this.
So you would see that, you know, the German fear of encirclement is something that existed primarily in their own imagination, but not in reality.
I would say that they helped to provoke it by their policies.
We're coming towards the guns of August, and we went straight into that. But is there anything you see in the 4 or 5 years leading up to August 1914, where historians can say, you know, these were the moments of no return? Or actually, would you belong to the school that takes the view that really right up to the last moment, a more sensible leadership, primarily from the Kaiser, could have prevented a world war?
Well, I certainly think a more sensible leadership from Germany could have. If the Kaiser had conveniently fallen down and broken his neck, the situation might have been somewhat different. But yes, I think that it would have been helpful to a great extent to have had different policies followed in Germany and also in Austria. The Austrian general staff under Holzendorf did not exactly cover itself with glory in terms of a prudent assessment of the situation. And look at the mess they made of attacking Serbia. Very good biography by Lawrence Sondhaus on that, incidentally, on Holzendorf. So yes, I think, You asked me what school. I'm not sure that I belong to any school. I would hate to be so tied down. But what I have always argued is the role of contingency, of circumstance in history, and that actions have consequences, but many of those consequences are unpredictable. That, I think, is equally germane to the situation today. And I would like to close by urging listeners to think very carefully if they regard the foolish leadership of the Kaiser as in some way an add-on. I would like them to think very carefully about what they think about the nature and quality of leadership in some states in the modern world in the international crisis we are in at the moment.
Well, that's a very pertinent point to end a really fascinating discussion about Wilhelmine Germany. Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Brief History of Germany, which is published now in paperback. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And listeners, since we're talking about it, might be interested in my book on the Great War, which includes a discussion of the causes of the Great War.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.